Greetings, I'm Austin Egbert, Director of Mind Matters News. Welcome to another BingeCast, where multiple episodes are combined into a single program. This week's BingeCast features an interview with Peter Kulaba about his work and struggles in the medical field in Uganda and improving his ability to provide patient care with data analytics. Enjoy.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head-on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
Greetings. One of the missions of the Walter Bradley Center is exploring and cultivating ways AI and other advanced technology can be applied in developing countries. Unfortunately, governance in developing countries is sometimes hindered by inefficiencies born of corruption and an uncaring bureaucracy. Dr. Peter Kulaba from Uganda knows about this from firsthand experience. Most Americans know about Uganda from when Idi Amin was president. Idi Amin is best known as the big ego bloviating president of Uganda who sheltered terrorists and their hostages in 1976. The hostages were freed in a daring commando raid by Israel. Forrest Whitaker won an Academy Award for his portrayal of Idi Amin in the 2006 motion picture, The Last King of Scotland. But Idi Amin is long gone. Uganda's governance, though, is still considered by many to be somewhat corrupt and untrustworthy. There are Ugandans, though, that still strive to make their country a better place to live. One is our guest today, Dr. Peter Kulaba. Dr. Kulaba is a physician from Uganda, who is looking at business intelligence and data analytics to solve terrible mismanagement of medical facilities and misuse of medical supplies, including medicine. And we're going to be talking to him today about his use of data analytics and business intelligence in solving these problems. Peter, thank you for being a guest here today. And I talked to you before, and I learned so many interesting things. You mentioned that in Uganda, there is a lot of mismanagement and medical challenges. Could you talk about some of the medical challenges that exist in Uganda today?
First of all, thank you for having me here.
Okay.
Where do you start? I think there are a lot of things that are getting better in Uganda, but we still do have a huge challenge. The primary one of them is that we do have a very high patient-to-doctor ratio. It's in the thousands, almost, if you count the number of students who've graduated from university, from medical school.
So for every 1,000 citizens, there's one physician, roughly?
Yeah, almost for every 1,000, if you count the number of people who've graduated from university.
Oh.
If you count it in real numbers, you probably have 10,000 people for each medical doctor. And if you go to a rural environment, it's probably 30,000. Then you do have a very inefficient drug management system. So every year, almost every quarter, we do have in the newspapers an article, like some I shared with you, where they're throwing away almost a third or a quarter of the drugs that were procured for that season. So if you can imagine almost a quarter or a fifth of the national budget on healthcare.
A fifth of the national budget on healthcare.
Of the drugs that have been procured mm-hmm. go to waste every year, and that's money that could be used to treat people. You have other inefficiencies in hospitals. So
how is the money wasted? Do they spend it on, do they buy too many aspirins?
Sometimes it is buying too many aspirins when you need something else. Is one of the sad stories was there was a procurement for cancer drugs, and the Cancer Institute ordered for three drugs, and they bought two of the three. And you
needed all three of the drugs for it to work.
Of course, you need all three, you know, the combination to make it work. So you can imagine the two types that were bought were useless without the three, so everything went to waste. And so you had cancer patients not having medication, you know, so that there is inefficiencies like that. I mean, the problems are not just limited to the government, though. Is there are problems in the private sector. A lot of them having to do with the fact that sometimes you just get so overwhelmed trying to treat or make a difference or do whatever you're doing or make some money from the process because it's not a very lucrative it's not as lucrative there as it is here.
Yeah.
And so you have people running those businesses until they run them down, and every fourth or fifth year they're starting a new medical facility.
Now, why do they run them down? Is it the idea that they're just looking out for themselves as opposed to the patients, or why are they run down?
It's a mix of a lot of things. It's on one hand, you're trying to do something good and survive doing it, and you fail to do that. On the other hand, you just have poor data management, and so you do not really know what you're dealing with, and that feeds into your planning cycle. It feeds into the rest of how you operate and how you run things. I had the experience of having set up a facility, and I remember my experience was working for somebody else and saying, I have to do this and I'm going to do it different, you know? And then I start, and 4 years later, I'm like the person I left, you know?
Oh, is it you become what you don't want to be?
Yes. And I realize, well, you know, I probably judged the guy too hard. It's because here I am, I'm struggling to pay bills. I'm struggling to do this. I'm dealing with an inefficient insurance system where bills get paid 6, 7, 8 months late. Sometimes, the billing system is out of whack. Sometimes you're dealing with a lot of patients who cannot afford their treatment. Very poor loyalty to the process.
And this is when you were working for the government, is that right?
This is when I was working privately.
Privately.
Is my challenges when I was working for the government were in a whole different ballpark.
Oh, gosh. One of the things that we talked about, I think most Americans are chilled about. I remember reading a book, gosh, it was over 15 years ago when I first learned about the Marburg and the Ebola virus.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that this is not necessarily in Uganda, but in West Africa, kind of an annual or a semi-annual occurrence. It's something which breaks out.
In Central Africa, so I know that most Americans, the most recent experience or the biggest picture they have of Ebola is what it did in West Africa recently, because that made global headlines, you know? And it was interesting because sometimes when Americans think about Africa, they think about it as one country.
Yes.
And so it's interesting how far Uganda is from Nigeria. So in Central Africa, where the Democratic Republic of Congo is found and Uganda is... Yes, it's probably an annual or a biannual cycle of Ebola or Marburg. So it is more common than most people think. I would give credit to the governments in the region there for that. I think in Central Africa, where people are used to Ebola and Marburg, there is a very rapid emergency response. So I guess that's where you never hear about. Well, it might make some news, but you never hear about it a lot in America or anything like that, because unlike what happened in West Africa, where they just didn't know what they were dealing with, I guess it had to do with people moving up from the Congo into West Africa, and so they introduced something that there was just no knowledge of, is for us, the moment somebody shows up with a weird fever or a hemorrhagic fever, everybody kind of knows what to do.
So therefore, the governments have their ducks in a row as far as dealing with Ebola and Marburg,
right? About a decade ago, we had a very bad episode of Ebola. And I think a lot of people learned a lot of lessons very quickly.
I bet. They learn quickly and die.
And since then, I think there have been 4 or 5 outbreaks. But none of them has ever claimed more than, 20, 30 people? Which is good.
Yeah, I guess decent if you're talking about comparative figures, I suppose.
Yes.
I know that you have lived with the consequences of medical inefficiencies and the lack of medical supplies in Uganda.
Yes.
And could you share some of those? Because I think that us sitting here talking about it in the abstract is very much different than you actually living that challenge.
Well, like we discussed before, I think it was in 2001, 2002. Fresh out of medical school, ready to take on the world.
Yes.
Christmas, it was Christmas Eve. Both on Christmas Day and on New Year's Eve, on both days, I happened to be on duty at the emergency unit in pediatrics. And yeah, we lost like 22 babies on one of those days and 19 on the other.
22 babies were lost, and then 19.
I shouldn't call them babies, but I mean children below the age of 5.
Yes.
You get? And it's one of those experiences where you're helpless or hopeless. I don't know. So we had the blood. I mean, they all needed a transfusion. So we did have the blood to transfuse them. We did not have the kits.
You didn't have the needles.
The needles to get it in. And I hope I don't get arrested for this. I and my colleague on duty on both those nights, because we were both on duty those nights, we whenever we used to be on duty, we used to use part of our salary to try and buy some needles, you know, to help, because there was always somebody who showed up for whom the needles had run out and we needed help and they couldn't buy their own. Or we would go into the other wards in the hospital and go pinch some needles, put them
you would
in our.
Steal.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to use the word steal. But technically, we would steal them. And go and use them, you know, to help. That night, those two nights, I remember them like yesterday, is we'd used up everything we'd stolen. We didn't have any money to help. And so we had the experience of holding child after child over a 12-hour period and just watching them die. And we just literally watched them die. And so you come off from that, and I guess that tests your resolve on whether you want to stay on and make that difference or just go off and do something else.
It has to take a large personal wage to do that.
I think that drove me away from serving within the government.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just didn't want to deal with that again. I did try privately to continue to practice. I then moved into HIV AIDS care.
Yeah.
Which went well for a long time. I mean, we had Senator Brownback come at the beginning of the PEPFAR program and we launched that, and then we started having issues because they made me have to choose patients.
You had to choose patients. Was this the HIV thing we talked about?
Yes, I had to choose patients.
Tell that story, because I think along with the loss of the lives of the babies and children, this one is just, it's just gut-wrenching.
Yeah, so at the beginning of the PEPFAR program, before that we had an arrangement, a subsidy program from GlaxoSmithKline, where they were subsidizing medication for patients. And then PEPFAR came along, and so we transitioned to PEPFAR. But the clinic were...
You translated to what now?
PEPFAR. It was a presidential initiative on HIV/AIDS care. George W. Bush program for Africa. It was a $5 billion fund or something like that. And so when that started, of course you had fund implementers down in Africa. And so we were running, I think, 3 clinics at that time. And one of them happened to be in the more Beverly Hills kind of neighborhood of Kampala. It's a place called Kololo. And we were running that clinic there not because we were treating the rich people in the neighborhood, but because we'd figured out that we could see a whole lot more patients in there because they could get, there was a lot of stigma in care, and so they could get to the clinic without being noticed. So when the program started, they said, well, your clinic is located in Kololo, so we're not going to include it in the program. And and so then we had the back and forth. And so I stuck my neck out and claimed that, you know, these are our poor patients who need help. As you remove the subsidy from them, they cannot afford the full cost of drugs. It's going to be a problem. So I think as it hit back to me, I was told, okay, fine, go pick 1,000 patients. At that time, I had 4,500 patients.
You had 4,500 patients.
Yes,
and so I was told, you gave them all very personal care, right?
Yes, and so I was told to pick 1,000 patients, and you can't pick more than one person from a family. So I had the job. Within 3 days, the news had gotten out that I was picking patients.
As my understanding, there was a government edict that with the treatment of HIV, only one person per family could be treated.
It wasn't the government.
Oh, it wasn't the government.
It was a fund implementer issue. So the the organization mandated by the US government to help implement in Uganda passed down that edict, and I had the job of picking 1,000 patients out of 4,000. And so then having to sit down with parents and ask them, you pick one of your children.
This is like a Sophie's Choice, if you're familiar with the movie, where she had to choose which of her children lived and died, on the line of a Nazi concentration camp.
Yeah, with the understanding that your bills are about to go up for the rest of your care. You've been paying 50%. It was actually 60% subsidy on the rest of your medication. Suddenly, you're going to pay 100% for the remaining members of your family, and we get to pick one who will get free treatment.
Well, Peter, thank you for that insight. One of the, there's a number of things that I'd kind of like to talk about. One of the things, as you said at one time, because of these involvements you were in, you ended up with 4 cell phones.
Yes, I did.
And then I learned, and I didn't know this, that you could actually get a cell phone with a card that actually allowed you to use more than one number, which is kind of cool. So could you tell us about why you had 4 cell phones or 4 phone numbers in Uganda?
Well, I'd always told myself I'll never do that until I started having to field calls at 3 a.m. in the night, in keeping with having to make Sophie's choice over those HIV patients. And so I'd get a phone call at 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. and on the other side would be, Dr. Peter, I'm coming to see you today, but I need your help and somebody's crying. And so I figured that, okay, fine, I need a new phone line.
So people were crying because they were coming to you and they said, we have more than one person with HIV in our family and I can't choose just one.
Yes, and they'd been struggling. I mean, a couple of them already owed me money, quote in quotes, because I'd already been paying for some of their medication and they owed some people in the facility money for advancing them care. They had offered, I used to get an offer to buy a piece of property almost every week. And so they were really struggling but I also needed to sleep. And
I thought doctors during their internships were taught to go without sleep for weeks on time, weeks.
It works in some ways and doesn't work in others. Uh-huh. And so, I mean, I was married. I needed to sleep but I also needed to be on call for my family or for other emergencies.
And you have a wife and 3 lovely daughters. Yes. You needed to spend time with them.
Yes. So I ended up with a second phone line, then a third phone line, just to, to segregate what I could switch off when, so that I could be able to effectively operate. And
now I think in the United States, most physicians would have receptionists that would actually filter the calls that came through. You didn't have that luxury, I suppose.
Well, medicine in Africa is a bit more personal than it is in the United States.
Okay, so it was more being personal than it was having those extra resources.
Yes, but also, I guess, particularly in HIV/AIDS care, you become a keeper of secrets, if I may use that phrase.
Really?
I like to say that.
And the doctor-patient confidentiality sort of thing?
Yes, you become a keeper of secrets and you become a member of a family. I attended baptisms, weddings, funerals. I spoke at graduation ceremonies. I adopted children, quote in quotes. I had to raise up some teenagers. And so people become your friends. And I mean, they moved on from just being your patients, because you knew so much about them that they couldn't share with anybody else.
I see.
And so
I think we have long lost that personal touch in the United States with physicians and patients. I think here it's a much more colder relationship, much more professional, I should say. One of the other things that you mentioned is that doctors working for the government in Uganda don't get paid a lot, and there's been a lot of doctor strikes.
Yes, I think in the last year they've gone on strike 2 or 3 times.
Just in this last year they've gone on strike?
Yes. Too many promises, too little money.
I see.
I think it's one of those rock and hard place things. Is the government doesn't have that much money. The doctors are not paid that well. you face a challenge as a doctor working for the government that you might not be able to educate your children to become doctors.
Oh.
So I do not know how in the end you can solve some of those challenges with greater efficiencies that data analytics and
things. Well, yeah, we're going to get to that.
Could deliver.
Yes.
But yes, it's a challenge. And as I shared with you, is I did participate. I was a survey participant in a piece of research probably 10 years ago where they interviewed members of my graduating class and the five classes above us and five classes below me.
This is for the medical doctor degree.
Yes, for the medical doctor degree. And they found out that almost 50 to 75% of our graduating classes for that 7-year, 8-year period were not in the country. I mean, they'd all left to go do something else. I mean, to go to another country, whether it was the United Kingdom or to Asia or to South Africa or something else. They were not practicing it within Uganda. And then to make matters worse, of the 40 or so percent that was still practicing within Uganda, only about 30 to 40%, 25 to 40%. I mean, I need to get the study out, but were seeing patients. The rest were all doing some form of research because I don't want to say that's where the money was, but also that's where the impact probably was, is where you could see something happen when you did something. So I mean, you have Walter Reed, you have John Hopkins, you have Baylor Children's Hospital, you have Case Western. They're out there doing research and running research programs or programs on behalf of USAID.
What's USA? US
United States Agency for International Development.
I see.
And so, those are $3,000 to $6,000, $7,000 a month jobs. Compared to 1 million shillings a month for the government, which is what, $350 a month?
Wow, so the research pays a lot better.
A 10 times factor.
A whole order of magnitude, wow.
is sometimes, it's a difficult one asking people to look away when that's the choice they have been presented with. So,
what would you say to somebody that says maybe those hospitals should get out, quit doing research in Uganda so that these doctors would dedicate themselves better to taking care of the Ugandan people?
You know, I think there's a huge debate on the benefit of what the hospitals do in Uganda. I mean, I've read articles where people talk about guinea pigs and how these Ugandans are being used as guinea pigs. And I think that's one side of the story. The other side of the story is I think those hospitals have made a big contribution. Now, it might not be the contribution everyone likes, but I know people who receive care simply because they participate in research. I mean, they're research participants. You get? And they wouldn't receive that care any other way. You know, they have access to the latest and best medications because, well, it's a piece of research going on, but they wouldn't be able to afford it. Nothing would happen. Plus, you have a few centers that have come up because they have primarily been built by using grant funds, which I don't think would exist without that. So I find that debate a bit difficult because we might not totally agree with everything that happens. And nobody really wants to be the guinea pig, but...
Well, that was my first reaction. When I heard all these hospitals were there, I thought, why Uganda?
Yeah, but you know, I wouldn't want to be the one to have that debate.
To make that situation. Yes. Well, let's get down. You are pursuing a graduate degree in information science, because you have done some really cool pioneering work applying data analytics and business intelligence to aspects of medical care in Uganda, and they have, my understanding, had striking success. And one of the reasons you're pursuing this master's degree is to see what else you can do. Can you tell us your experience thus far in applying the data analytics to improving medical care in Uganda?
Well, as a caveat, I want to first say that I think the striking success is realizing how much data and analyzing data and using data for decision making would make a difference. I think I'd like to say that was the biggest lesson learned, because where we apply the data, the business still, the healthcare facility still closed down. I don't want to say too late for it, but it was a bit too late. It had been a facility operating, had operated for 7 years.
So you're talking about a specific facility now?
Yes, where we applied it. But it was a great learning point. Is, I think, after getting to a point of frustration running my own practice, it was a small 5-6-bed hospital offering antenatal and postnatal care and surgery. And of course, we did see patients. We had physicians in there and everything. I did get to that point of frustration. I went off, did my MBA in the Netherlands. And as we were doing that, we had the course on decision sciences.
So you have an MBA also. I didn't know that.
Yes, I did.
Okay.
So we do this course in decision sciences. And as I look at that and work through that and work through the supply chain program also, I realize, well, you know, this I think this is a problem that we have, is we have a lot of information sitting with us. We've just never used it. So along with a classmate of mine who was working at Philips at the time, we got permission to go down and see if we can use the tools we were using, mainly Excel-based tools at that time, is to see if we can improve this the outcome for this business. We go down and we just gather in the data from the SQL server, run it through a Palisade program, which is an Excel analytics program, and we built a couple of models, predictive models. As we built them out, we found out, for example, that a few interesting things, like we were running a 24-hour care facility. We find out that we didn't need to have it opened every night, because the patients we had admitted for 6 years all used to come roughly at a certain amount, at a certain point in time. And so if you cross that period of time, there was only a 6 nights in a year that you'd have a patient show up after that time. So we made a decision on our overnight care just based on data we got, saved ourselves $35,000 for the year just by doing that.
Wow. And discovered this from the data.
Yes, we never gathered any complaints from patients. It was interesting. No one ever came and knocked. Is the data told us that we had a 6-year record of data. We predicted what would happen. We played around with the model and what it did.
With your data analytics, you also had forecasting in there somewhere.
Yes. Okay. And so we did what it did, and we got an immediate saving that we could apply somewhere else. We then moved on to see how should we place doctors, you know, because we'd have patients complain at certain points in time of the day that they're not being seen. And we had things like that. We started placing doctors based on data. We then moved the, we then analyzed procurement data, because we were at a stage where every month we were throwing away drugs worth $500 a month, $500, $600 a month.
Because it expired or?
Yeah, because it expired and things like that. Is we moved to the stage where, I mean, two things happened. First of all, our waste became less than $500 a year from $500 a month.
I see.
Secondly, we were able to introduce or optimize and introduce a just-in-time system for drug procurement, because we suddenly could predict based on diagnostics, based on other diagnostic information, everything. We could predict what medication we needed when, you get? So our entire procurement chain started being driven by data. So we had a secondary saving, is we then knew when we needed to buy certain medicine. And so the number of patients we had who were being disappointed because we didn't have the drugs they needed when they needed it, that almost vanished. You know, we solved almost 95% of that problem. We had this interesting period where we were having a problem with malaria, where we were treating patients for malaria and they kept coming back, you know, to be retreated. And we because we were gathering data and analyzing data, we were able to say, well, something weird is going on here. And we actually ended up reporting that to the malaria consortium. to a friend of a colleague of mine who was doing research in that area, and they were able to find out that they actually had a batch problem with the medication as being ineffective and also a testing problem. And we found that out once we were looking at the data, and we could then say we're having an unusual trend of malaria diagnostics going on here. Is it a person problem? Is it an equipment problem? Is it a disease problem?
Yes.
So, I mean, that very simple system started giving us that information that fed into various things. I mean, there's so much we got which we didn't expect on the front end. We could begin to tell which doctors were performing well and which doctors were not, you know, just based on the type of diagnostics, the diagnosis they were running, the prescriptions.
That's fascinating. I wanted to talk about the pronunciation of Uganda. I actually talked with Peter about that, and I said, is it Uganda or Uganda? And he said, Uganda is French. Is that right?
That's a more French intonation of the name. And Uganda is the way it's pronounced. And I was telling you, the British never have a problem pronouncing it. So it's interesting that the Americans do have a problem saying Uganda.
Well, it's like there's an old song, you say potato, I say potato, you say tomato, you say tomato. And I have been known to say data instead of data. And people laugh at me for that. But of course, I'm from West Virginia, so it's okay to say data down there.
So. Yeah, I know it's I also say data. And so I have to keep remembering now I need to say data.
No, you need to say data. Very good. Let's continue with some of the things that you did with business intelligence and data analytics and the incredible changes that you made with your particular medical facility in Uganda. You talked about some of them. Could you kind of recap what those were? And then we can go on and talk about some other topics. Yes. What is the impact of your elementary analytics, data analytics?
So as I was saying, one, we were able to determine how to manage our night shift just by running data on patients' attendance and what happens whenever we admitted a patient at night. And I know for some people that's strange because we actually used to admit mothers, you know, to have their babies delivered. I have to do cesarean sections at sometimes, but we for the 2 year period we played with the data and ran with it. We never had a mother show up and were not ready to receive her. You know, we were able to start predicting through things like that.
But that means you have to staff 24/7, right?
Yes, we had staff who could respond immediately to an emergency or something like that. But more importantly, we were able, because part of it was cost saving, we were able to not just stay open for the sake of staying open, because this was a community healthcare facility, is we're able to know when we should stay open or when people should stay over at night. And that immediately delivered a $30,000-$40,000 saving.
It's incredible.
Just by doing that, which is money then that was available to do something else that we needed to get done, is we were able to make decisions on procurement of medication. We were even able to determine whether we were having errant doctors.
Errant doctors.
Yeah, I mean, or how to support our doctors for their training needs.
There's an old joke in the United States. Do you know what they call the medical doctor that graduates last in the class? They call him doctor. Right? It doesn't matter where you graduate in the class. The bottom of the bottom physician in the graduating class is also called doctors, and you have a gradient of quality, and that's what you're saying here.
Yes, I mean, I don't understand how doctors graduate.
Well, somebody has to be last, right?
Somebody has to be last.
Yeah.
The issue is if they get above 50, they're a doctor.
Right. Okay, but you were saying that the rebellion.
So I mean, every once in a while. It's sad, but I think progressively you've had quality issues in training. I don't want to go too much into that, but that has been happening. So we also use data to identify how our doctors were performing. Because if somebody just had the same diagnostics all the time, had the same prescriptions, had the same everything, is that's a red flag. You know, so we...
So somebody came in and no matter what they had, they gave them this same medication.
Or they seemed to always get the same medication, or they didn't observe seasonal trends in disease patterns or something like that.
Wow.
Because now we had seasonal data. We knew when to expect malaria. We knew when we'd have peaks in cough and flu. We knew things like that. We had 6 years worth of data and the cycles to work with. And just based on that, if suddenly you're having, like I did suggest, we're having this malaria syndrome occurring, too many people coming in with malaria and having to have repeat tests and repeat medication, is we knew something was wrong immediately. Whereas previously, when we're just running this as a billing system, is we'd be happy. We're having more patients, we're treating them, and we have money. You know.
So if you're talking about just the income.
Yes, because that was one of the other things that, I mean, drives me to think through how can data be used better in a country like Uganda? Because I know it's the same even in Kenya, which is our neighbor. Is almost every medical practice now has a billing system in place. It has a system where they can tell how many patients have come in and how much money they're receiving from those patients. The gap in there is a failure to recognize how much data they're actually collecting. Because they're not only collecting data on the patients that have shown up. They're collecting data on how many patients have shown up, the ages of those patients, the diagnosis those patients are receiving, or their primary complaints. They're collecting data on how much time they spend in the facility, because you have an entry record and you have an exit record. That's time. You can collect information on how much time they spend at each station. So how do you engage them better through the process? Should you introduce a triage? How long should a triage last? What other ways can you engage a client while they're in the hospital? Is you're collecting information on how quickly you respond to patients, how quickly they come back, you know, for a checkup. You're getting compliance data. There's so much you're getting. I mean, you can't run after every rabbit trail, but you're getting so many important things that can improve an experience of care, can improve management of care, and can reduce cost. And so you can leverage a reduction in cost. Is one of the interesting things we're able to do. We actually increased our consultation fees at the clinic, you know?
Yeah.
And the patients took on the increase because their overall bill was still less.
Wait, how did that happen? How did their bills go?
So because we were now able to attend to them much better and more efficiently, they got the drugs they needed, we were able to intervene with the doctors to make sure they were being treated correctly and things like that, is when, for example, we suggested they needed a medical test, they trusted us on the test. They knew there was a process to that. So their repeat visits came down. Their overall annual budget came down. We started having patients, because we were seeing a lot of patients who didn't have insurance. We started having patients who said, we want to open an account with you because we feel you have an efficient system for how our money gets used.
You know, so you developed a reputation, a branding in a way.
They could see the value in the process. And the clinic, the practice had so many problems that we couldn't solve all of them, you know. But the information we used had been gathered from the very first day that it opened. We dealt with it 5 years late, 6 years later. You get 6 years late, if I may even say it that way, is just I have had long nights thinking, if only we had done this 6 years before, the story would have been totally different. And it's tragic because I do know a lot of practices within Kampala, within Uganda, that have closed or keep closing down. Because they say, oh, this doesn't work, you know? And when you sit down to work through what's going on, you realize it's an information problem, it's a data problem, and how data is used. Everyone had a billing system. So everyone was gathering information every single day.
That's the takeaway that I had from you. You said that the information from Unit was so rich because everybody might not keep records on everything, but everybody kept billing records.
Yes.
And so therefore you had this rich database that you could tap in order to apply your data analytics.
Yes. And so everyone has it. So I think that was a tragedy for us. Fortunately, we discovered it and were able to see how it could work. So that's why I said that's a caveat. That was a big lesson, seeing how the data could make the difference. It's still a tragedy because I know people who are still looking for a new billing system.
Oh, I see.
And yet what they need is a better data management system that actually gives them information they can use to stop waste, to prime the doctors, to optimize the system.
Now, in the business intelligence software that you use, you could actually take data. You could actually take data and you could make forecasts with this data, and you could actually apply it to the software, and it would make a forecast on what would happen if you made these changes. Is that right?
Yes.
That's incredibly powerful, and apparently it works. Do you think American hospitals and medical facilities use this sort of business intelligence today, or do you have any idea?
Well, I'm not sure. I've seen billing systems because they still sell them as billing systems even in the United States.
Okay.
I do believe that data is used to do some certain things. I do not know how much. So at this stage, I wouldn't have a good answer for that.
How widespread is your system being applied, say, in Uganda?
Beyond what we used it for, it's not something we launched out.
I see.
You know, beyond that, I had to let go of that practice. I've ended up here doing the graduate program in information science.
Is your idea for doing the graduate work in information science to do more, to amplify, to make more powerful the work that you've done? Is that your reason?
Yes. That's one of my primary reasons. I believe that a lot of the problems in Africa, in Uganda in particular, have to do with disorganization.
Oh, really?
Have to do with disorder and inefficiency. Now, I do not believe data science will solve all those problems.
A lot of that is actually generated by human beings, isn't it?
Yes, but I believe it's just inefficiencies that can be solved just by having better information to make decisions. So I think living in a country where a fifth of the medication bought is thrown away.
Wow.
Almost $20 million worth of medicine thrown every year is, oh, where you buy 2 out of 3 drugs for a cancer program. I think those things can be solved by data, and they can make a difference for a lot of people. I believe that data analytics has a place to play in building rapid response systems and bringing efficiencies there. I think if the savings like the ones we had in our practice could be replicated across practices and hospitals in my country, is that we'd probably find money to pay doctors and nurses better.
Yes.
While not adding an extra burden to patients, because right now those patients are paying for the waste and paying for the doctors they can't see. I believe data has a role in improving training and in determining appropriate training for doctors and nurses. And that's just healthcare. Beyond that, I believe data has bigger roles to play in the rest of how countries like my country run. I think data is part of decision science.
Yes.
It has the capacity to help people make better decisions, planning decisions. And I think that offers opportunities that don't exist in countries like Uganda. And so that's a driver for me in doing the MSIS program. Is, I also believe it's God's call on my life to be.
Yeah, I was going
to
ask you, what motivates you? Because
to be efficient and to be, I mean, people always ask me what I think about Christianity. I think Christianity goes beyond just evangelism. It also goes into impact is we need to be able to use the faculties God has given us to make a meaningful impact. So I've had to face a trade-off. Do I sit in a clinic in Kampala treating people, or do I participate in trying to be part of a wider solution to make a difference for more people so they can have better care? I believe God has called me to the wider picture, is create the environment for better care, create the environment for better planning. And I think I am convinced data analytics, predictive analytics has a big role to play in making those things happen. Now, as to whether the people buying the drugs would like to have a more efficient drug buying system, I can't answer that because they're obviously people who benefit from those inefficiencies.
Well, I certainly can tell you have the fruits of a Christian. We talked before about you spending your own money on extra HIV drugs and on buying needles, I guess, kind of from the black market
pharmacy just outside the hospital.
Oh, is that right?
It was a very lucrative business.
It's not the black market then, huh?
No, it's not. It's,
but you spent your own money on that, and certainly that was above and beyond control. I think us at the Walter Bradley Center have a similar sort of calling. Certainly we subscribe to the Judeo-Christian ethic. We talk about the idea that humans have abilities above and beyond computers, and we're also interested in applying some of these ideas of AI to developing countries in terms of sustainable technology, appropriate technology, and the sort of data analytics that you've talked about. So this is really great. Peter, wow, what a wonderful three episodes that we've had with you. Thank you so much for being a guest today on Mind Matters. Until next time, be a good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.